Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're tuned into CFRU. This is Lil Shazam, and this is...
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
On Monday, August 21st, a solar eclipse will be taking place between 1:08 and 3:48 p.m., peaking at 2:30. If you'd like to experience the eclipse in its full splendor, come on out to the University of Guelph Observatory to view the partial solar eclipse through the telescope. You can also view the eclipse with the naked eye using personal solar filter cards, which you can then take home while supplies last. The University of Guelph Observatory is located on the 7th floor of the McNaughton Building, unfortunately not a physically accessible location. Take the elevators to the 5th floor and walk the last 2 flights to the roof. All are welcome, so bring family and friends. Come on out and view the solar eclipse on August 21st, beginning at 1:08 p.m. at the University of Guelph Observatory, part of the university's physics department. Capacity is limited, so don't be late.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning, 7 to 9. CFRU 93.3.
Be an everyday hero in your community. Parkinson's Super Walk takes place this September. Since 1990, the event has been raising awareness and funds to support Canadians with Parkinson's, their families, and the health professionals that treat them. Participate at one of the many locations across Canada. To register yourself or a team or to volunteer, visit online at www.parkinsonsuperwalk.ca or call Parkinson Canada at 1-800-565-3000. A stranger answers, I hesitate.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And talking a lot about, of course, the media and how basically imperialism and the exploitative forces that dominate society control the media to a massive degree and manipulate us towards war and potential destruction. These are very grim things. And there's nothing new about this. But the important thing to remember is that people do resist. There's nothing passive about how human beings respond to these inhuman things which they deal with in the world. People do resist. They do fight back. In 1934, the great German communist playwright Bertolt Brecht wrote an essay entitled Writing the Truth, Five Difficulties, which he begins by saying, quote, "Nowadays, anyone who wishes to combat lies and ignorance and to write the truth must overcome at least five difficulties. He must have the courage to write the truth when truth is everywhere opposed, the keenness to recognize it, although it is everywhere concealed, the skill to manipulate it as a weapon, the judgment to select those in whose hands it will be effective, and the cunning to spread the truth among such persons. These are formidable problems for writers living under fascism, but they exist also for those writers who have fled or been exiled. They exist even for writers working in countries where civil liberty prevails. And in this era of omnipresent imperialist propaganda and scaremongering, these are very important words to keep in mind. Now, I'm going to play an interview that Max Blumenthal of Alternet did on this whole Russiagate thing I've been talking about. This is an interview he did with the Real News Network. I played it on the first show I did when I got back to when I started back in the USSR again last month, but I didn't finish it. So I'm going to finish it right now. I'm going to play that the complete interview right here, which really delves into a lot of the stuff I've been talking about. But please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Mattei. At their first ever meeting, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin agreed to a ceasefire in southwestern Syria. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson hailed it as a major step forward.
This de-escalation area was agreed. It's well-defined. Agreements on who will secure this area. A ceasefire has been entered into. And I think this is our first indication of the U.S. and Russia being able to work together in Syria.
Despite that news, U.S. media appeared more interested in another development from the meeting. Tillerson said Trump confronted Putin about Russian meddling in the U.S. election.
They had a very robust and lengthy exchange on the subject. The president pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement. President Putin denied such involvement, as I think he has in the past. The two leaders agreed, though, that this is a substantial hindrance in the ability of us to move the Russian-U.S. relationship forward, and agreed to exchange further work regarding commitments of non-interference.
Tillerson also said Putin asked Trump for proof of the alleged Russian interference. So far, the Russiagate affair has relied on the claims of leading Democrats, some U.S. intelligence agencies, and anonymous officials. Joining me is Max Blumenthal, best-selling author, journalist, and senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. Welcome, Max.
Good to be with you.
So, a lot of focus on the on Trump bringing up election meddling with Putin, but it seems like this Syria ceasefire in southwestern Syria is a pretty big deal. Max, your thoughts on this very hyped-up meeting between these two?
Well, I'll start with the alleged ceasefire. I don't know if it's a big deal or not. It's something that should have happened a long time ago. It's happening within the context of these deconfliction zones. And the deconfliction zones have been actually a driver of conflict, at least at the around in eastern Syria, on the border of Iraq, around the Awalid border crossing, near the town of Tanef, where the U.S. has set up this 150-kilometer deconfliction zone. The Russians are very upset about that and believe that it will result in, or it sets the stage for, the federalization of Syria. In other words, the breakup of Syria and the partition of it. Part of the ceasefire plan as it emerges is to leave Assad in power, but we've seen the schizophrenia of the Trump administration on display as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, while cutting this deal, which is clearly a deal that would leave Assad in power. And I don't know who else they think would come in. Like, would it be Jabhat al-Nusra chief Mohammad Jolani? Like, there isn't really a successor. While cutting this deal, he did call for a transition, which sounds like something, you know, from 4 years ago. It sounds really 2000 and late to me. So I don't know what he's talking about. Southwestern Syria has been a place that I've heard think tank experts from, for example, the Middle East Institute in Washington, which is funded by the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and these countries, as a place that would be sort of part of the partition. It would be, you know, not part of, not under the Syrian government control. So I think we have to wait and see what the ceasefire would lead to. But obviously, any kind of ceasefire, any form of de-escalation in the near term is a good thing, because it will lead to less people getting killed. And as we've seen, a UN report that was issued last week found that 440,000 civilians who have been internally displaced by the Syrian civil war, in other words, they've fled from rebel-held areas, areas held by the U.S. and Gulf-funded rebels, into the government areas, have actually been able to return home and reunite with their families because those areas have been retaken from the rebels. So de-escalation is going to actually relieve the refugee crisis. Going, you know, back to the issue of, you know, how the meeting with Putin has been covered. I mean, the U.S. media, there has been some coverage of the details of the negotiations, but very little. We've seen very little detail. I mean, if you're watching this right now, you know, do a cursory Google search and look for details of Trump, the Trump administration's discussion on the Minsk agreement with Putin and Russia. That's the agreement to that should lead to a de-escalation of the conflict in Ukraine. There's very little details the U.S. media is providing. Same with Syria. What we've instead seen is psychobabble about Vladimir Putin and how he will sort of dominate Trump in this meeting. Now, let's assume that Putin is so clever and so nefarious that he's going to dominate Trump. It's very clear that Putin is probably a more competent leader than Trump. I mean, Trump doesn't have a very high foreign policy or diplomatic IQ, and he's clearly a malignant narcissist who operates on receiving approval. Like, I'll go along with all that. Well, let's just assume Putin gets what he wants and they cut a deal. What would that deal would take place? Would it mean that the U.S. would hand over its sovereignty to Russia, that Russia would have more freedom to hack our elections? It's not even clear what would happen. But we've seen the most ridiculous psychobabble. For example, we saw in the New York Times an absurd rumor that Vladimir Putin once brought a black lab to a meeting with Angela Merkel in order to intimidate her because she was supposedly afraid of dogs. I don't know what kind of person, except maybe a bizarre German person, would be afraid of a cuddly black lab. But Putin was actually at home in Sochi. The lab was there. He didn't bring it to the meeting. The lab just kind of wandered out. Merkel looked a little bit nervous. And then, I looked online for pictures of Merkel and dogs. And there are lots of pictures of her greeting rescue dogs in Italy, for example, and going up and shaking the dog's paw. Putin denied that he brought the dog to scare Merkel. But this is just reported as fact. And then you see these 5,000 retweets from some NBC producer I've never heard of. Like, this is all you need to know about Vladimir Putin. Today, let me give one more example just to show I'm not, nitpicking. The New York Times, I mean, I got to read this. This is awesome. Called on a Russia expert to psychoanalyze Russians in the Russian mind. This is like the racist stuff we saw about Arabs and Muslims after 9/11 as we were going into the Middle East for the Forever War. His name is William Taubman, and he does appear to be some expert in Soviet history. Here's the insight he provided. When they get drunk, Russians will often say, "You respect me, don't you?" That was his quote in the New York Times. This is how we're supposed to understand the Putin-Trump meeting. I mean, this is absurd. And it's what led to the display, the juvenile adolescent display by the U.S. press before Lavrov and Tillerson, where all they could think about was Russian meddling. And what was Lavrov going to say? What was he going to say? So this is just the quality of the media we're getting. It's actually very much reminds Russians I know who are liberal Russians who are, not very friendly to Putin, of the kind of media they see back home, of the domestic propaganda they get.
Yeah, Max, you mentioned the New York Times, so I just have to point out that this is the same New York Times that recently published Louise Mensch, this conspiracy theorist whose contributions to the Russiagate affair include suggesting that Putin was behind the protests in Ferguson. But, I want to get back to Syria because you mentioned Russia.
Can I interrupt real quickly?
All right, but then we're going back to Syria. Go ahead.
There's a guy named Clint Watts, who's a former FBI agent. He's all over CNN and MSNBC. He's been in the Daily Beast. The Guardian quoted him yesterday.
He testified before Congress.
He testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that Russia was behind Black Lives Matter. Okay, so these nutcases are still out there. These Mensheviks are still out there, and nobody cares about that. And Louise Mensch is not a bad apple. You have a whole crew of Mensheviks who are pumping their toxicity into the suggestible brains of elite liberals.
There's a lot to talk about Russiagate, but just staying with Syria for a second. You mentioned the deconfliction zones, and I just want to clarify for people who aren't familiar with that what that is. So that is a zone that the U.S.-led coalition has established inside Syria, and they've used these zones to actually fire recently on Syrian forces and Iranian-backed proxies. And so are you saying that this record here and the fact that the U.S. has used these deconfliction zones to fire on Syria and its allies as grounds to be skeptical of this new ceasefire agreement between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, it's allowed for a de facto U.S. base in eastern Syria. And Colin Kahl, who is a former advisor to Joe Biden and was in Barack Obama's National Security Council, I think. Not exactly. This isn't, you know, Noam Chomsky or even like, you know, someone even crazier like Max Blumenthal talking. But he said that we've established an Alamo in eastern Syria that we will have to defend. It's a terrible idea and will only lead to escalation. I think I even saw John Podesta criticize this idea. Someone whose Podesta group just took up a $1.7 million contract with the Saudi Arabian government to lobby for them. So it's not like it's a sort of, you know, far left anti-imperial, that criticism of this is limited to the left. I mean, this is clearly a bad idea, but it's what the Trump administration is doing to establish leverage with Russia at least the U.S. moves towards a kind of partition. Now, the most dangerous area that I don't think we're discussing, there isn't much discussion. You know, if you want to read analysis of that deconfliction zone, we covered it at the Gray Zone Project at Alternet, analyzed it. Ben Norton wrote a great analysis for us. But the issue of Raqqa is going to be a huge problem if we don't understand what the U.S. agenda is for Raqqa and for the towns around it. Raqqa is an Arab city. It is a Syrian Arab city. You know, its interior is still partly controlled by ISIS. They're going to be ousted by the Syrian Defense Forces, which is armed and trained by the U.S. It's a mostly Kurdish militia, which is now kind of acting as an arm of American power in eastern Syria. When ISIS is removed, what happens to the Arab residents of Raqqa when a mostly Kurdish force moves in? The U.S. seems to be indicating that the Syrian government will not be allowed to take control of Raqqa. Brett McGurk who's the head of the U.S. coalition against ISIS, has already taken tours of towns near Raqqa, which have been captured. And those towns are not able to pay their teachers, their electricity hasn't come on, and it's because of the U.S. deconfliction line. It will not allow the Syrian government to restore control, and so people there are suffering. I spoke to someone who I would describe as close to the Kurdistan Regional Authority some weeks ago. And that person told me that the residents of Raqqa will, quote unquote, decamp. Will the Arab residents of Raqqa, the Sunni Arab residents of Raqqa, be ethnically cleansed by a mostly Kurdish force under U.S. control to prevent the Syrian government from reestablishing its authority in eastern Syria? That sounds like a terrible scenario to me, and something very dangerous as we move forward in Syria, and also something that anyone who's remotely concerned with human rights should be worried about, along with the weapons and the mass civilian casualties the U.S. is causing there already.
Well, Max, let me ask you on the point of the Kurds. I mean, do they have a record inside Syria to suggest that possibility might happen? And haven't they said taken great pains to stress many times that they don't have designs on territory beyond what they already control in northern Syria?
No, there's no record of it in Rojava or Manbij in these areas. These are, you know, Kurdish areas, but now they're moving outside areas that are Kurdish. The U.S. is pushing them to do so. What happens? Who holds the deconfliction line for the U.S.? What if the people of Raqqa have a different idea in mind? What if the teachers and the public employees want their salaries restored? Brett McGurk told the New York Times, this is the head of the U.S. coalition against ISIS, that while the U.S. intended to provide chalkboards and desks in this area, it was basically going to turn to the UN for everything else and displace all responsibility for the civilian population onto the UN to avoid allowing Syria to take control back of Syria. This is, you know, not only classic imperialism, something that Russia is not doing in Syria because Russia is returning territory to the Syrian government. It is a recipe for complete disaster and more human catastrophe.
So, Max, in terms of how Putin and Trump are discussed here in the U.S., I want to play for you a clip from today. This is the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, being interviewed by Andrea Mitchell of MSNBC.
If President Trump does not raise the issue of Russian hacking, Russian meddling in our election, what's the impact?
Well, I think one thing is that Putin will be even more emboldened to continue their activities. And looking ahead to 2018-2020 elections, they're going to be more aggressive about it. In fact, the reports that came out yesterday about increased Soviet or Freudian slip, Russian collection activity in this country, which I think is probably part of this, and is he's simply
they're sending more spies here.
Yeah, exactly,
Max. So that's James Clapper and Andrea Mitchell. And what I found interesting there was we're not just talking now about 2016 and how Russia helped Trump win through their fake news and hacked emails. But now they're talking about sending more spies to the U.S. And the discussion I'm seeing now is how this is going to influence the next elections and how we all have to get ready.
Well, first of all, this is James Clapper, who lied under oath to Congress and has twice said in recent weeks that he believes that Russians are genetically primed to interfere in foreign countries, that they're genetically primed to subvert. You know, this is the language we would expect from someone maybe titled Obergruppenführer Clapper. But it's not any language that betrays an objective analysis of Russian goals or the Russian geopolitical agenda. We heard a lot of hysteria. I guess it was somewhat justified. We heard a lot of outrage about statements Trump made in Poland about Western civilization being under attack from without and from within. By subversion. He even used the term subversion, this being kind of classic fascist rhetoric. And, you know, it does sound like a lot of the neo-fascists in Europe, but it also sounds a lot like the liberals. And if you browse the headlines at the Daily Beast, I mean, I just did a quick browse, you'll see headlines warning that Russia aims to subvert the entire West from within. And you'll hear rhetoric like Clapper's about the genetic tendencies of Russians. So there's a hysteria on the other side by Trump's opponents about subversion of the West from without and from within. And in many ways, it's unfounded. I don't believe that Russia has the ability to subvert a democracy that's already in deep decline. It does have the ability to allow us to project our internal contradictions and our problems onto a foreign country. Clapper was referring in that report to completely anonymously sourced CNN report about ramped up Russian spy activity. I don't know if that means that Russian spies are taking Adderall now or that there are more Russian spies, but when CNN reported it, it was sourced entirely to anonymous intelligence officials, anonymous senior intelligence official. So whatever anonymous intelligence officials say, CNN believes, and the opponents of Trump swallow it whole. I don't know where the evidence is, and it's just like Russian hacking. We have nothing to evaluate here. We have no concrete evidence to analyze or evaluate. We simply have to believe all spooks. And that's, once again, it's dangerous because it prevents kind of the internal reflection and the confrontation with ourselves that we need to have, along with an objective analysis of what diplomacy with Russia should look like and what the U.S. can accomplish cooperating with Russia to de-escalate conflicts in places like Syria and Ukraine.
Yeah, Max, and you know, amidst all this discussion and focus on Trump and Russia, it's easy to lose sight of what we're talking about in terms of what Russia is accused of doing. It's fake news and hacking emails, which is just so relatively trivial compared to the kind of interference that the U.S. does around the world. It's an obvious leftist point to make, but yet it's just lost on so many people.
Yeah, I mean, even if Russia had hacked the DNC, for example, that would be elegant compared to what the United States did to Russia and Ukraine, what the United States did to Russia in the 1990s, and what we've sought to do to them again and again, or what we're currently doing with every country that rejects a total U.S. alignment from Venezuela to North Korea. It's just there's simply no comparison. But, you know, the larger point to make just about media coverage is that there's fake news, and CNN is pumping out a lot of fake news. But there's also non-news. And I think non-news is more dangerous than fake news. There's very little issue-based coverage, and there are a lot of issues out there. The acquittal of Philando Castile's killer kind of passed without much outrage at all. I don't know how that took place. It was one of the most outrageous things that took place, and the media was just consumed with this narrative of foreign subversion. When CNN's Russian meddling narrative started to fall apart with the suspension or firing of three reporters over its report on Scaramucci, the former Trump transition official, I thought, okay, finally, we're going to move on. We might see some real coverage. And then Trump tweets out a GIF, which, you know, was silly and harmless, but obviously idiotic and unpresidential. And we see the return of the non-news, this kind of mock battle between an elite media and a loudish president, with all of these, you know, corporate shills pretending that they're rebel dissidents under attack, like they're, you know, Roman Christians hiding in the catacombs because a president tweeted out a GIF. And so we had another week of non-news. So I think we need to discuss the deliberate deployment of non-news to paper over real issues.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I want to thank you for joining us. Max Blumenthal, best-selling author, journalist, senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. Thanks, Max.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow combat, EB, I born that, beaches storm that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascist, crapped in pantsers, stanzas, cure cultural cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, get back like church has to get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you the flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on now, aw shit, pump your fist if you know where we are, that's a rap, boom, bap, original rap at, taking shit back, boom, bap, boom, bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, 250 watts of community power.
Help drag cancer through the mud on Saturday, September 16th at the Canadian Cancer Society's Mademoiselle in Guelph. This 5K mud run is open to all fitness levels. So whether you're looking for a competitive obstacle race or just to enjoy a day of fun in the mud with your friends, head out to Cox Creek Cellars, 7687 Wellington Road 22, on September 16th. Whether you're a survivor or want to support a fighter, join your fellow Mademoiselles in raising funds for Canada's most promising cancer research and support services. Because when life gets messy, we stick together. Register today at mademoiselle.ca. This event is unfortunately not physically accessible.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning. Seven to nine. CFRU 93.3.
Be an everyday hero in your community. Parkinson's Super Walk takes place this September. Since 1990, the event has been raising awareness and funds to support Canadians with Parkinson's, their families, and the health professionals that treat them. Participate at one of the many locations across Canada. To register yourself or a team or to volunteer, visit online at www.parkinsonsuperwalk.ca or call Parkinson Canada at 1-800-565-3000. A stranger answers, I hesitate.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. The talk we're about to hear by Dr. Michael Parenti is titled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Michael Parenti is an author and political analyst. Among his books are The Sword and the Dollar, Inventing Reality, History is Mystery, and his latest, The Terrorism Trap. This talk was given in 1989 in North Hollywood, California, during the administration of George Bush I, an administration consisting of most of the same players that occupy positions in the present Bush administration. In the talk, Parenti looks at the entertainment media as a propaganda vehicle for American ruling class interests and attitudes. With the recent spate of war movies and TV shows glorifying the CIA, FBI, and police, this 13-year-old talk is eerily relevant. Control of media is even more concentrated now than 13 years ago, as most major media outlets are subsidiaries of massive corporations with interests in a variety of areas, including armaments. At the time this talk was given, Saddam Hussein was a great friend of the United States, and Osama bin Laden was, in the words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan, the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers.
I want to today give attention to the other side of the media, not the news media, but the entertainment media, because the entertainment media consumes a much larger share of the viewing time of most Americans than do the news programs. And I thought I would call this book something like The Hidden Political Images of the Entertainment Media. And then as I thought about it, I said, well, what's so hidden about it? It's rather blatant. And what I looked at are Hollywood films. That's what I'm studying. Hollywood films and TV dramas, TV miniseries, teleplays, and the like. What I find is a real abundance of images and ideologies, ones that are essentially supportive of imperialism, anti-communism, capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, say militarism twice, militarism, authoritarian violence, vigilantism, and anti-working class attitudes. More specifically, I found these kinds of themes. Individual heroics predominate over collective action. There's almost no collective action. There's almost no story or drama where the people organize together and do something for themselves. I mean, there are one or two exceptions. When they do, when there is collective action, they're usually led by some hero who has to spur them on and really do the whole thing himself. Free enterprise is the best economic system in the world. That's a message which is not necessarily telegraphed so much as it is presumed. Certainly, there's nothing positive ever uttered about alternative systems in the entertainment media. Private monetary gain is a central and worthy objective of life, although those who are too wickedly greedy, the Dynasty guys and Dallas fellows, they can meet with disapproval. Sometimes business characters are insensitive to other people's needs because they're so busy with their business activities, but when properly apprised of the problems and such, they are suddenly capable of legendary acts of generosity, which I've never seen in real life, but I see on television dramas say, the kid needs the house, give it to him. They give him to give it to, I'll give the factory to Joe, he's a good guy, and all that sort of thing. Workers are beer guzzling, regular Joes, I mean, good natured and all that, but really not very bright, incapable. If I was to say any one consistent stereotype I've seen about how blue collar people are portrayed in the media, with the exception of certain films, by the way, everything I say, there are a few notable exceptions, with the exception of a film like Silkwood or A Matter of Sex, a few others, they're almost always incapable of leadership and of acting as agents of their own lives. One wonders really where labor unions came from. Labor unions are always up to not much good. They're rather insensitive to the needs of workers. Some years back, there was a TV program, Archie Bunker, All in the Family, which was supposedly against various forms of bigotry. And while it came out against the bigot, who was Archie Bunker, and made a little message statement against bigotry, every program practiced a bigotry of its own by portraying the working person as this goof and goon. And one of the big laugh lines in All in the Family was when Archie Bunker mispronounced a word, committed a malapropism, and the canned laughter would come on. That's not funny. There's nothing funny when somebody mispronounces a word. I mean, all you're saying is that he hasn't had the opportunity to have the education that some other people have had. But class bigotry is a very common form of bigotry, and it remains totally unchallenged, unlike gender bigotry or race bigotry, which at least is challenged today. The practices and forms of class bigotry go on in abundance in the media and remain unchallenged. Affluent professionals in almost all programs are considered much more interesting than blue-collar or ordinary service workers. There are many more of them as principal characters. Women and ethnic minorities are really not as capable, effective, or interesting as white males. Cop shows, the police and everyone else should be given a freer hand in combating the large criminal element in America, using generous applications of force and violence without too much attention to constitutional rights. In fact, in any number of cop shows, the cop will get up and talk about that Constitution isn't going to protect you, it's only me with my gun, and the hell with the Constitution. The ills of society are caused by individual malfactors and not by anything in the socioeconomic system. No, no, no. There are some unworthy persons in our established institutions, but they are eventually dealt with and set straight for the most part. U.S. military force is directed only toward laudable goals, or more often the goals are not even stated. It's just assumed that we've got to win this one. Nothing said about what kind of interests are involved. I mean, after all, why are people doing all this fighting and killing? It's a question that remains largely unstated. Western industrial and military might, especially the U.S.'s, has been a civilizing force for the benefit of backward peoples throughout the Third World. The United States and the entire Western world have long been threatened from abroad by foreign aggressors, such as the Russians, communist terrorists, Arab terrorists, and generally the swarthy hordes of less developed peoples. Those are, I would say, some of the general themes that come up again and again in any number of movies. And the last one is the one I want to focus on today. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they could be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, And the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train. Now, once you kill and once you plunder like that, once you go in to take another people's land and steal their labor and enslave their labor and take their resources and preempt and take over their markets, once you do that kind of act, and it wasn't the ordinary people of Europe and North America that did it, it was the ruling interests that did it, and they used our taxes, our money, and our sons to go fight. But once you do that, you have to do two other things ideologically and psychologically. One, you have to deny the humanity of your victims. They are subhumans and they are moral inferiors. As John Wayne said in one of his horse operas in 1953, he said, "There's humans and then there's Comanches." A very clear message. He couldn't have said it better. There's humans and then there's Comanches. You're not killing human beings. You're killing these wild animals. By the way, you can get the same quotes from Winston Churchill about the Afghanis. You can get the same quotes from George Washington about American Indians. And you can get them from any number of imperialists. The second thing you do is you must ascribe all your crimes to them. You deny your own inhumanity and you accuse your victims of doing to you what you have been doing to them all along. Sometimes imperialism can take on an endearing, tender note, though. I found one movie which I want to share with you. It was with little, cutesy, adorable Shirley Temple. She was in the movie called, ready for this, Wee Willie Winky, 1937. And she asked her grandfather, who's the British colonel. They're off there, way out in some place where the British have no business being. And she says, "Why are you mad at Khoda Khan, leader of the, quote, warlike tribes?" The British colonel answers tenderly, "Oh, darling, we're not mad at Khoda Khan. England wants to be friends with all her peoples. But if we don't shoot him, he'll shoot us." This is sort of the Pat Buchanan, Cap Weinberger approach to foreign policy. Now, another interesting thing, these defamatory stereotypes and images demonstrate the unholy marriage between imperialism and racism. Marx has a very fascinating quote. I've got it in The Sword and the Dollar, of British officers in the Sepoy Rebellion in India. It was a contemporary account. The officers said, we hanged every nigger we found. In India, they're talking about India. They used the term nigger. We hanged every nigger we found. And every Indian they came across, they hanged them. The suppression was horrible. In South Africa, the people are called Kaffirs. In the Middle East, ragheads. In Asia, slopes and gooks. Well, these terms, nigger, Kaffir, slopes, gooks, this is a vocabulary of imperialism as well as a vocabulary of racism. And indeed, I'm not going to argue that imperialism is the cause of racism, but certainly imperialism is one of the biggest instigators and propagators of it. You have to finally define whole categories of people as different and inferior to justify what you're doing. Even when the imperialism is not of the violent sort, and even when the racism is not evident, it still can permeate a film sort of implicitly. Take the case of how Hollywood has dealt with Africa. The Tarzan movies, I won't even say a word. There, it's so evident and so obvious. We'll just say the Tarzan movies. Okay, I've proven my case. But let's go on. Let's go on beyond Tarzan, and let's take a more modern-day effort, finally. Finally, Hollywood, finally, in the 1980s, in the last 30 years, I've been waiting for an intelligent movie about Africa. There's 1,000 stories in Africa. There are stories of tribal conflicts, of generational conflicts, of urbanization, of cultural change, of labor struggle, horrendous, incredible level of labor struggle like nothing you see in North America, like nothing you see in Europe. 250,000 gold miners out on strike together, and they don't have computers and carpools and all that sort of thing. Incredible amount of discipline and organization and courage from a people who supposedly are not ready for self-government. 1,000 stories, 1,000 dramas that you can make. And so Hollywood finally makes a movie about Africa, and it's called Out of Africa. And what's it about? It's about an upper crust Danish literati whose major concern, it seems, is to hang on to her plantation and get it together with her beautiful blonde boyfriend, Robert Redford. That's what the story was about, played by Meryl Streep. And the Africans in Out of Africa, I kept looking for the Africans. And there they were, sort of around the edges, saying things like, is Sahib happy? Does Sahib want dinner now? May I do this for Sahib? Addressing her reverently. And then Robert Redford comes along and he sets her straight, because he's kind of gone native a little, you know, and he says, I want to show you my Africa, the real Africa. I said, hey, here it comes, the breakthrough. And what does he do? He takes her up in the plane, and you see those same old aerial shots straight out of the Tarzan flicks of the zebra herds and the giraffes running along. Still no Africans. And I said, ah, oh, this is why they named it Out of Africa, because there's nothing in Africa about it. Then finally we got to a really good film, and I do mean it, Gandhi, which at least portrayed Indian principles and showed the Indians acting with courage together, although it all came from the magic leadership of Mohandas Gandhi, apparently. And it even showed some of the brutality of the British. But even that film, I would have to make a serious criticism, because it gets to the heart of the political economy of the entertainment media. And that is that the political economy of imperialism was never shown in that otherwise fine film. The forced underdevelopment and impoverishment of India by British capitalism was never shown. The fact that when the British went into India between 1830 and 1900, the per capita earnings of the Indians dropped by 2/3. That India was pillaged. That poverty was not an original condition of India. India is a lush, fertile subcontinent. The poverty of India is a direct cause of the policies of British imperialism, which was to forcibly deindustrialize India. That could have been dealt with in some way. You know, you could say, well, you know, I mean, what do you want, Parenti? How can you do that in a film? I mean, you can't start reading tracts of Lenin in the middle of a film or chapter 3 from The Sword and the Dollar. You know, you just can't do that. But during the course of a movie, you can have some discussion, some word explaining what are the British doing in India. I sat for 3.5 hours through that film, and they never explained why are the British in India? What are they doing there? And you're left with the impression that they're in India simply because they like to strut about with their swagger sticks, and they simply don't have the decency to go home when asked to go home. But in fact, very powerful British interests got very rich off the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of India. A film that really deals in an uncompromising way, and in a very good way, it's not a particularly well-made film, but the script and the political content of it is terrific, was made in 1969. It deals with imperialism, the political economy of imperialism, too, and that was called Burn, an Italian-French production. It's nice to hear applause from the 7 people who are able to see that movie, because the distribution of that movie was remarkable. I mean, it actually dealt with the class interest behind it, dealt with the transition from slavery to free labor. You had Marlon Brando explaining why it'd be better, it would have less costs and all that sort of thing. This movie was suppressed in its distribution. It was taken out of circulation. It did not reach many theaters, and it did not stay long in the ones it did reach. And it would make a nice little story as to what happened to the distribution of that movie. There's another area where the wagon train paradigm exists, and that's right in the urban frontier. It's what Hal Himmelstein in his book on television calls the urban frontier. It's the fort, the wagon train, the encampment all over again, but it's in the middle of the city. Again, you've got the human beings, and they are under siege, and they are under siege again from swarthy hordes. There are plenty of TV shows, as you know, and plenty of movies. Let me just give you one called Cobra by Sylvester Stallone, who wrote it and acted in it. The comedian Jay Leno was right. Stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone deserve a lot of credit for opening up the acting profession to a lot of people who could not get into it back when speech was a requirement. Cobra is, and by the way, this has been a standard character over the last 20 years, in the last 15 years or so, in films and TV series. He's a whacked out Vietnam vet, bitter, wounded, angry that he couldn't win it. He wanted to win it, and you didn't let him win it. So now he's a detective in New York, and he fights the whole gang, and they are trying to terrorize and take over the city or the country or the world. It's not clear. And so it's cowboy versus Indians, cowboy singular, cowboy versus Indians. And Cobra goes out there, and again, the same thing, makes his talks about you pussyfooting with the Constitution and all these rights, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'll really take care of them. And Cobra doesn't believe in sissy things like arrest, trial, and incarceration. He just executes these guys. He just murders people, and one of the gang guys he captures, he douses him with gasoline, and then he lights a match. As he sets fire to the guy, he sneeringly says, "You have the right to remain silent." Now, the most durable version of the swarthy hordes, that external alien menace that's going to come at us, is the red tide and the red menace. You can defeat the Indians and the Bushmen, but communism is still around there, and it will subvert us from within, or it will inundate us from without. You remember Ronald Reagan's speech about Nicaragua? If we don't stop them in Nicaragua, the red tide will be lapping at our borders. That Nicaragua is only 12 hours drive from Brownsville, Texas. That's if you drive 180 miles an hour, but whatever. Well, that basic paradigm, that image, is being propagated by our presidents, our political leaders. And in the 1980s, the Reaganite cinema reached new heights of anti-communism, and Soviet bashing reached new depths, I should say. Rambo 2 with Sylvester Stallone. In Rambo 2, Stallone, he not only acts, if you want to call it that, acts in these roles, he also writes the scripts. And he turns around in that movie and he says to his old Green Beret commander, he says, "Are we going to fight to win it this time?" And he certainly does win it. He goes into Vietnam, and he kills a battalion of Russians. He kills the whole Vietnamese army. They throw napalm at him. He's captured by them. He's tortured. And he liberates prisoners of war. He's aided by the fact that his adversaries all seem to be legally blind. They cannot shoot straight. Hundreds of rounds are shot at him, and they just always miss, never fluff his hair. But while the movie is outrageous and it's ridiculous, again, don't lose sight of the fact that it's once more turning history on its head. I mean, in reality, the Vietnamese have exchanged prisoners of war with the United States after signing the Paris Peace Agreement, which ended the war. And that whole POW-MIA issue is really an outrageous, pandering exploitation of the unrealistic hopes of those families conducted by the Pentagon and the U.S. government and played upon by people like Ronald Reagan. You know, there are 18,000 Americans missing in action from World War II. Where do you suppose they are? Are they being held captive in Toyota factories or in beer cellars in Wiesbaden someplace or something? No, tragically, unfortunately, sadly, they're dead, and it's acknowledged that they're dead. But the 2,000-some missing from Vietnam have never been acknowledged realistically for what they are, which is that they're dead. Instead, that issue is exploited. It's not only exploited, but whole movies are made out of it. Not just Rambo 2, but Missing in Action 1, Missing in Action 2, Missing in Action 3, Bradford, Missing in Action 4, I think, is coming up soon. Second, U.S. prisoners of war were not tortured by the Soviets in Vietnam, as depicted in this film. They have Rambo being tortured by Russians. There is no historical record of that. There is, however, record of South Vietnamese-trained forces and U.S. special forces using all sorts of torture, electric shock, water treatment tortures on National Liberation Force fighters. Third, the Soviets did not drop napalm on anyone in Vietnam. You know who dropped the napalm in Vietnam. Just complete turning around. The U.S. dropped huge amounts of napalm and Agent Orange, something like 20% of the land. The whole food chain in Vietnam has been tainted. Vietnam was a country that had no liver cancer. It was an unknown disease because people ate sensible food like rice and grains and vegetables. And today it has one of the highest rates of liver cancer in the world because of what we did to their ecology chain. That's not what you get in the film. I guess you can get that kind of lying from somebody like Sylvester Stallone. If he could portray himself as a fearless war hero, even though he spent the Vietnam era working in a private girls' school in Europe, why would we expect him to play straight with the larger history, right? Rambo 3, Rambo is in Afghanistan now. And the Soviets are portrayed as sadists, rapists, and torturers who murder little children with explosive toys, a horror story that originated, propagated by the CIA, for which there's no evidence. I don't, the Red Army has got better things to do than...